Joe Miller is one of five candidates running for U.S. Senate against incumbent Republican Lisa Murkowski. He's running on the Libertarian ticket and has staked out positions on limiting federal powers, taxes, term limits, and a wide range of other issues. What are his thoughts on the most pressing needs in Alaska, and how does he think he could help address those needs if Alaskans vote to send him to Congress? We'll find out today when Joe Miller joins us for Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Do party labels matter? Joe Miller won the Republican primary in 2010, but lost the general election. Now he's running as a Libertarian. So what's in a party name? Let's find out. Hello, Mr. Miller.
Hi, Lori. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for being with us today. You out there in APRN land can also join the conversation if you'd like. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. I started with a question about party labels, whether they're important. Yesterday, the state Republican Party filed a complaint with the FEC against you, and later you held a press conference alleging unusual financial activity and planned to file a complaint yourself. Let's start with the GOP's complaint. They allege you failed to pay back your website for services like banner ads, email lists, calls for campaign donations, that you also have an Anchorage office that you've not listed as an expense or an in-kind donation. They have other beefs. What's your response to this? What do you say about these allegations?
Yeah, they aren't real beefs. In fact, it was designed to preempt our own press conference. I happened to be in Fairbanks at a forum yesterday morning, which, of course, Lisa Murkowski chose not to appear in. She's been playing pretty much hide and seek with respect to the Alaskan voters, doesn't seem to want people to know about her position. So we had planned a press conference in the evening, Alaska Republican Party, really still directed by the same corrupt leadership that has been behind the party for some time. One of the reasons why, and in fact, many of your listeners probably remember, a number of years ago, I challenged the corrupt party leadership of the Alaska Republican Party before I ran for U.S. Senate because I was concerned about corruption within leadership. Still the same directive, the same underlying leadership is in place. The names may be different. The powers behind the names are the same. They want to maintain control of their power. And the reason why is the same reason that I think we see a lot of dissatisfaction throughout not just the state of Alaska with the two-party system, but also throughout the United States, that the party systems are used to perpetuate power in such a way that the people and their interests are ignored, whereas the special interests are put forward. It's, as we put it before, it's kind of a funnel for special interest money. And this is one of the reasons why, and I've said this repeatedly on the campaign trail, that I think Alaska needs to go a new direction. The 36-year Murkowski dynasty has been about the easy money. The federal pot to Alaska, like I told all the voters in 2010, I said, look, yeah, this is going to continue to shrink. It doesn't matter who you elect. It doesn't matter if you elect Murkowski or Miller, you're going to lose earmarks, you're going to lose federal funding. But the problem is that when you operate according to the rules that you're there to direct money to special interests and to the cronies, you lose sight of what the people want. But the parties try to perpetuate that. My view of it is political leverage should not be directed toward getting it's not even more and more because the pot is shrinking, but getting as much as you can from that diminishing federal pot of money, but to instead focus on the things that we have here in Alaska to make all of us rich, to create jobs for everybody. That's not one of those things that works out for the crony capitalist because it's not shifting money into certain pots. Instead, though, it's working to make the economy of Alaska great. So that was a preemptive move on the part of the Alaska Republican Party. We uncovered some very significant problems, what we have described as money laundering. Over $150,000 after I announced my run for Senate was shifted as so-called surplus campaign funds from Murkowski's campaign into the Alaska Republican Party. They knew we were getting ready to make that announcement. They knew those were serious allegations, and so they tried to shift the eye of the public, again, because they want to maintain their corrupt power. I think Alaskans are getting sick and tired of that. It's one of the reasons why Alaskans, the vast majority of Alaskans, are not members of either party, the Democrat or the Republicans. It's one of the reasons why my campaign as a libertarian has taken, I think, has gotten so much support from the public. And of course, what's happened with yesterday is, again, a reflection of how much support we actually have. I believe that Murkowski's running scared. I think she believes that she could very well be beaten. And so they're trying to do everything that they can to undercut that support. It's not going to be successful.
Well, please go through the allegations that they have presented against you first, and then we'll go back to your allegations against the Murkowski campaign.
Right. So we held a press conference. I invited the press to ask any question that it desired about any of the specific allegations. It seems the interesting thing about this complaint is, on the one hand, they're saying we didn't disclose enough, and then on the other, we disclosed too little. Basically, it appears that their main beef, and it's not really a beef. Again, I want to make this clear. It was a peremptory move on the part of the Republican Party. It's all shiny objects. The same thing, you know, when we ran for the Senate the last time, the same operation was on the ground in the sense of websites, et cetera, that we have now. But the difference is you've got somebody that wants to shift the eye to something else. They've claimed that my website, we've got a campaign website, and I encourage all your listeners to go there. It's joeforliberty.com. We want listeners in Alaska to go to joeforliberty.com. They can support us there. They can donate there. I've had a website for many years, joemiller.us, started back in 2004. It's been in existence for 12 years. It's personally owned, the domain I own. Restoring Liberty is the name, the name of the news site that we've operated. It's the top political site in the state of Alaska. Restoringliberty.us or joemiller.us, you can get to it the same way. It's been the top political site in the state for about 6 years. We're proud of that. It's operating the chief editor is my daughter. It's an excellent site. As a candidate, page 29 of the FEC candidate handbook says, as a candidate, you can use your personal resources for your campaign. If you control the money in that particular entity that you're using, you can use it for the campaign. You got to disclose it, which we did. There's a $500 in-kind donation because there's a campaign advertisement on that website. You can go to joemiller.us, and up at the top, it says U.S. Senate website. You can click on that. It takes you to joeforliberty.com. We also, in the past, have had a number of stories about different political figures. If you go to joemiller.us, for example, and type in the search box, Murkowski, you're going to pull up all sorts of stories about our senior senator. Most of those stories are not complimentary. Most of them point out that she's not reflecting Alaskan values. And we're proud of the work that website has done in informing Alaskans about where the senior senator sits. Part of the problem that we have in Alaska, not obviously with public radio, you guys are nonpartisan, but there does seem to be a fairly, shall we call it, homogeneous view sometimes toward our senior leadership in the state, particularly Senator Murkowski. She has links to a number of different outlets in the state, direct links through Alice Rogoff to the Alaska Dispatch News, known as ADN, KTVA, John Tracy, who used to work for her, is over there. She's using these outlets to propagate basically information that's not accurate about her, information that's not accurate about her past policies or what she wants to do with Alaska. We felt it was necessary to provide Alaskans with another view. And so if you go to joemiller.us, you're going to see that. And it's one that represents federal libertarianism. My campaign is all about bringing power back to the people, to the local communities, to the states. I've said this repeatedly throughout the time that I've been involved politically in the state of Alaska, that for Alaska, that's a huge win. The more we get the federal government out of our business, the more jobs we can create, the greater wealth we can create. Lori, you and I were talking about the funding issues with public radio. It's my guess that probably your donations have even gone down because of the PFD issue. Half the PFD is gone, in part because our economy in the state of Alaska is suffering. We're in the third quarter of a recession. we almost certainly are going to hit recession next quarter too, or we're going to continue to see a decrease in economic activity. These things are all a consequence of, again, the federal government not allowing us to use the resource base that we have to create jobs. So those are the kind of perspectives that we present in that site. Again, page 29 of the FEC handbook says I can use those any way I see fit. They've got to be disclosed, which you did. On the one hand, the ARP is saying you disclose too much or you disclose too little. Which is it? You know, they need to get their story straight. But again, it's all about shifting the eye of the public onto another issue, shifting it away from the issues, from the fact that Lisa Murkowski doesn't represent Alaskan values, and shifting away from the fact that that 36-year Murkowski dynasty has led Alaska down a dead-end road.
When did you decide that you were going to come forward with these allegations and plan to have a press conference about it?
It was days ago. And in fact, the first time that we saw that, the PR from the Alaska Republican Party was after we'd already scheduled our press conference. So that's the sequence of it. They knew that we were having a press conference. They ended up then, of course, issuing their complaint or whatever you want to call it. And again, I'm quite certain it's because they're very concerned about the allegations of money laundering. I mean, again, surplus campaign finance, according to the FEC, our FEC attorney called the FEC staff, and the FEC staff said it was, quote, unquote, highly unusual, and would, at the very least, require, quote, an advisory opinion, end quote, before that type of thing happened. I think something was filed this morning requesting more information through the FEC to find out what is going on with those funds. It certainly raises a specter of money laundering. It certainly reflects that Lisa Murkowski is trying to get some other group to do her dirty work because she wants to fool again the Alaskan voters as to what she's actually doing.
Do you intend to, I know that yesterday there was, the statement was made that you may file a complaint, but that there was concern about when a decision would come down. What's the thinking there?
I received an email from our FEC attorney this morning. I believe something has been filed this morning. I believe it takes the character of a request for information. So it's a little bit distinct from a complaint, but it's requesting that the ARP, Lisa Murkowski, come clean with what they've done.
All right.
And again, you know, I think this is important, too, for your listeners to understand. These issues are not going to get resolved until after the campaign. This is all shiny objects trying to distract the voters. Now, I think we've seen a lot of this at the national level, too, of people that want to maintain power trying to do anything they can to maintain it.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is Joe Miller. He's running for the U.S. Senate on the Libertarian Party ticket. You can join the conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's the number statewide, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. Or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's get back to the issue of party labels. I kind of started the show with that. You ran as a Republican. Now you're running as a Libertarian. Why run under that flag rather than just unaffiliated? Why run under a Libertarian ticket?
So this has been a very highly unusual race, Lori. Obviously, I've been very interested in changing the leadership of the state of Alaska because, you know, I moved my kids, my wife here over 20 years ago, and it was for the opportunity of Alaska. And I've just shook my head over the years as I've watched the opportunities that we have pass us by. And again, it's because this corruption, really, this political corruption that we faced, where we have political leaders say, hey, we're for opening the resource base in Alaska. But when you actually peel away what they've done, they've worked the opposite direction. I mean, in fact, Lisa Murkowski with the appointment of Sally Jewell, we saw the OCS changes, offshore drilling, Chukchi Sea development go away, half MPRAs off limits, no movement toward ANWR at all. And that's because she's really not fighting that direction. She's fighting for that, what we used to call the easy money, but that ever-diminishing federal pot of money so she can shift it to those that basically support her and her views. That has been perpetuated by the two-party system. When I was presented with this opportunity, and this came to me, I was called by the former chair of the Libertarian Party and said, hey, Joe, our nominee is thinking about stepping down. Would you be interested in being our nominee? This just happened a few short weeks ago. I mean, your listeners probably remember there wasn't a lot of press on it, but it was September 6th that occurred. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary opportunity. I talked to my wife first. Actually, the chair called me a few days before the 6th. The 6th was the deadline. The first thing I did is said, hey, Kathleen, what do you think about this? Because it's normally the families that take the brunt of these campaigns. You ought to sit down and talk to my wife about some of the stuff that we've gone through over the years, and she is just an extraordinary woman. I couldn't be prouder of Kathleen. She's served the state well. She's been on the Judicial Council. She's been involved in a lot of leadership within the state. But as a candidate's wife, I mean, it's just unlike anything else. And the first word she said, you've got to do it, Joe. You've got to do it. This state, the nation depends on you. We want to make sure we have new leadership so that our kids have opportunity. We've got 8 kids. We've got several of them in college. I've got one that's a second lieutenant in the Air Force. They're very interested in the future of the state. They love the state of Alaska. They want opportunities here. And simply the dead-end road that we've been led down by the Murkowski dynasty the last 36 years or so, it just hasn't provided that. So I said yes. The paperwork was filed September 6th. Libertarian, the Libertarian Party, Alaska Libertarian Party, if you go to AlaskaLibertarians.com, they've got a fantastic platform. It was completely in line with my views that I've expressed publicly in the state for the last several years. Federal libertarianism, this concept of getting decision-making back to the state, to the local communities, getting the feds out of the areas they aren't supposed to be in. It's something that is an absolute jewel for Alaska. It's something that will provide jobs and opportunity for our kids and grandkids if we can actually pull this thing off. So it's been a very short and intense campaign. If it's successful, it'll be the first time in history that a libertarian has won a federal office. It provides fantastic opportunity for Alaska. There are a number of pundits that believe we're going to have a split in the Senate. If that happens to be the case and I'm the tiebreaker, I can probably leverage that position into a good majority leader that can have the interest of the state of Alaska at the forefront, like Mike Lee. I mean, if he's the majority leader, he's in Utah. Federal government there owns most of the land, just like in Alaska. We have commonality and purpose. I think there's real opportunity if this actually happens, if Alaskans honor us with their votes, and we win the election on November 8th.
All right, let's go to the phones. Brian is in Anchorage. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Mr. Miller. First off, I'd like to thank you for your service to our country. The tank actions in which you took part during Desert Storm inspired me to join the U.S. Armored Cavalry. So your actions in that 100-hour campaign had a massive positive impact on my life. And I believe it is a wonderful thing that we have to have veterans continue to serve as leaders in our community. That being said, I received your weekly email newsletter for the past 3 years. Nearly every Sunday, I read articles from your website attacking scientists, science, and scientific consensus with no empirical evidence or even the most basic peer review to support them, even going so far as to accuse scientists of starting a bizarre religion based on scaremongering. UAA's medium-sized database features tens of thousands of studies that were subjected to both repetition by other researchers and vigorous peer review that can easily prove these slanted pieces of pseudoscience wrong upon even the most cursory inspection. If I printed off the number of papers in just my small niche field of stable isotope biogeochemistry in support of the consensus regarding anthropogenic climate change, the stack would be taller than you. My bark beetles and my spruce trees are not liberal conspirators. The mass spectrometers that I use to conduct my research are the same as the ones used to test purity and efficacy of pharmaceutical drugs and are based upon the same physical concepts as the phone in your pocket. Modern medicine and your phone work every day based on the same laws of physics that tell us that the climate is changing and the humans are the cause. So my question is this. I genuinely crave a free market side to the discussion on addressing science policy and combating climate change. But how can you expect reasonable people like me to vote for you if you and your team run what amounts to a conspiracy website, deny basic science principles because they think you they challenge your personal beliefs?
Hey, thank you, Brian, for your service.
Thanks
I appreciate
for the call,
that.
Brian.
And you know what? It's very encouraging that the candidacy from several years ago, the understanding of what it means to serve has motivated others to serve. I think that's a huge thing. I think we need more combat vets in Congress. I've been endorsed by combat vets for Congress. It's important to have people that understand the military, the importance of national defense there. And so I champion other people being involved in the political process also who have served, put their lives on the line. And thank you, Brian, for your service. First, I encourage people to go to joemiller.us. Research everything that you want there. There's a search box. If you got questions, we have had a number of people on our site. I've actually interviewed people as a radio talk show host that have a contrary view on the anthropogenic aspects of global warming. The point that I've made consistently politically is that if we're going to make changes in the way we do things, there has to be a cost-benefit analysis. That is key. Anybody that runs around saying that, hey, you know, we've got to impose a dollar a gallon tax because of global warming, or we need to have a carbon tax that's going to jack your rates in the villages from, you know, 50 cents a kilowatt hour up to 75 cents a kilowatt hour, you need to understand that those costs have impacts too. People, when they don't have money, they end up having health issues. They can't get medical care, just like the PFD thing I was talking about before. And by the way, Laura, I started the Save the Recall effort, or Save the PFD Recall effort, back in July before I decided to run for Senate, before I was offered the position on the Libertarian ticket. And the reason why is because I think it is catastrophic when government decides to take from those that can afford it the least. And what we have with this issue of a lot of the do-gooders out there that say we've got to do all these things to address global warming, they really don't care about the people. They don't care that they're causing people to not be able to heat their homes, not be able to drive their cars to their work, not be able to put food on their table, not be able to get medical care, because they really don't care they're jacking energy costs 25, 30, 50%. Some of these proposals out there would kill people. There's no question about it, because cost, when you incur cost, you create more cost for families. They aren't able to provide for the care they otherwise would have, and it does have that kind of an adverse impact.
What about the effects, though, of climate change?
I don't think anybody denies that there's climate change. I don't think you can look around you. There's always climate change. That's something historically that has taken place. If we're going to make an assessment of what needs to be done, we've got to determine the cost-benefit analysis. What's best for the people? What is actually going to save more lives? And I happen to be a human-centered person. I think that what we should do is make sure the decisions we make are overall, in their utility, best for people. And if we're hurting people in the process, if you talk to the man or woman on the street and say, hey, you know, if there's a 1% chance that this additional $1 a gallon gas tax is going to reduce global warming, would you like to pay a dollar more a gallon in gas and reduce your disposable income by 20% every year? I will assure you that 95% of the people you talk to will say, absolutely not, Joe. I need that money for my family. You know, and so that's the type of thing that I'm talking about, is that we can't be these pie in the sky folk up there that say, and by the way,
it pie in the sky when we're talking about, there was a report just this morning talking about new research that reveals Antarctica's ice melt rate is, the researchers are saying the ice is melting faster than we've ever seen. These things are happening. We've got people in coastal communities in Alaska who are at great risk. They are being harmed by what's happening, storm surges. And there does have to be a response. What is the proper response?
The proper response is one that benefits the people the most. And that's what I would say. And one of the things that we don't want to do, and this is a point that I made several years ago when I ran for office, the cap and the carbon tax approach. The thing that is just extraordinary about that is that I talked to a bunch of coal producers back in 2010, and basically I didn't even know this, but apparently the coal producers had gamed, these coal producers that I talked to had gamed the carbon tax thing, where they were actually going to be making money off the carbon tax trade. And when we really scraped all the different layers away from this, it was more crony capitalism. That this whole scheme, you know, it's to control global warming. In reality, there was one main objective, and that was to enrich those that had access to the senator. And that's a fact. And guess who got to pay the bill for it, had it actually passed? The people would have paid the bill for it. And guess how much impact that would have had on global warming? Probably zero.
So and should there not be, what should the realistic look be at the impacts of anthropogenic contributions to the atmosphere, to a warming planet? There was another report just this morning from the BBC looking at the surge in renewable energy systems across the globe. Alaska has, as you well know, been dependent on oil for decades. But what should the future look like? Should the federal government subsidize fossil fuel development and or renewable development? What's the right path forward? Should they not be subsidizing either one? What would you advocate for?
I think everybody remembers the word Solyndra, right? And many of these green energy companies had connections to the president and members of Congress. They ended up spending their subsidies for their own benefit, and it ended up creating bankruptcies that guess who paid for it? Again, the American people did. And so, you know, when we evaluate these things, so very often the whole system is geared toward one thing, and that's enriching those with access instead of helping the people. Now, nobody in the state that I've ever ran into, Lori, is for polluting the environment. We all came, I mean, I came up here because not just the extraordinary opportunity, but the extraordinary place that Alaska is. None of us want to see it polluted. Obviously, pollution controls need to be in effect. Obviously, water controls so that our water is not polluted. All those things need to take priority. There's no question about it. I don't believe that we ought to subsidize fossil fuel extraction. There's no reason to do that. We need to create access so that we can gain the benefit of that resource. That doesn't require subsidization. I think that renewable energy sources are a great thing, especially I have an advanced economics degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Got my master's degree in 1 year up there in Fairbanks. Graduated in the top 1% of my class at West Point. I'm not an anti-science guy. In fact, I read more science than a lot of people do. I believe in science. The fact of the matter remains that we have to approach this in a rational way. Not, the chicken little, the sky is falling, let's go ahead and put a dollar a gallon gas tax so that people can't put their food on the table. That's the issue. We're made up of people in the state that are just average people that don't want to see their livelihoods taken away. We're already under the third quarter of recession in the state, half our PFD gone because, again, these attitudes of the people don't matter. And that's really what motivates us. And I know there's a lot of idealists out there that think we've got all these solutions, but if you scrape away the layers, almost all the solutions have to do with government control, taking from the people, and enriching those with access. And that's what I'm against.
Well, I want to come back to that idea of subsidization later, but let's go back to the phones. We've got callers stacking up. Mike is in Kodiak. Hi, Mike. Mike? I guess Mike is gone. All right. Well, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we will take more phone calls and more questions as Libertarian U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller is our guest today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Joe Miller, Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, is our guest today on Talk of Alaska. You were just in, well, you're from Fairbanks, but you were in Fairbanks at AFN and talked a lot about rural Alaska and the needs in rural Alaska. We have a caller on the line from Bethel. Helen is calling about subsistence and land into trust issues. Mm-hmm. Hi, Helen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Joe, I'd like to ask you what you think of land into trust and our subsistence and native sovereignty, and what about poachers who take our big land animal moose and then just leave the whole carcass and take the head? Those kind of things, that's not how we live. And I just wanted your view. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Helen.
Thank you, Helen. Those are all wonderful questions. I appreciate that. I'm actually going to be in your community right now. The plan is to be there tomorrow on Wednesday, and I'd love to see you while I'm in Bethel. Native tribal sovereignty is something that we've been consistent on. It's a major part of our platform. Article 1, Section 8 provides that tribes are sovereign. It's a constitutional issue. There's a concept of parallel sovereignty that I think is also an out or a solution to the subsistence issue. Native Alaskans own 44 million acres in Alaska. I've always just been astonished at the fact that they aren't managing their own land. One of the problems that we have in Alaska right now is that the federal government just took over this year a total of over 100 million acres for federal fish and wildlife management. It shouldn't be happening. It's happened under the watch of a delegation that said they're fighting for Alaska. That's what Lisa says, and yet she has allowed the federal government to take over 100 million acres in the state. The problem is that the D.C. values don't match Alaskan values. A lot of people in the bush recognize that when the federal government talks about wildlife management, they aren't talking about maximization of the game for the use of the indigenous subsistence populations. Very often, it's a fight with the federal government to actually do predator control so that we maximize the game. I believe that if there can be a new relationship, and this is kind of transformational, and it requires a different perspective of the state government, but a new relationship between the tribes and the state, and not one where the tribes are just have a seat at the table, but are actually co-managers of wildlife with the state, especially on that 44 million acres, that it then provides opportunity to displace the federal government from that 100 million acres that they've now gained control over. There's a way by which you can actually, with a memorandum of understanding between the state and the tribes, then provide a means by which we could displace the federal management that doesn't match Alaskan values. And it allows the tribes to maintain and create some control and also some benefit for the people. Great. There were a couple of other questions. I'm a hunter by trade. I mean, my family, we eat primarily game from Alaska, fish, moose, et cetera. In fact, I gave up my moose hunt this year for this campaign. I was scheduled to be on a week-long moose hunt when the call came in right before then. And so we had to give that up. And so I'm a little short on moose meat this year, but I think it's absolutely despicable if somebody doesn't use the resource that they shoot. I mean, there's not a lot of people out there that are doing that. But when it happens, obviously, the full force of law needs to be applied to it, because it's something that I think our Creator designed for our use and not for waste. Lands into trust, Helen, that's a difficult question. One of the concerns that a lot of people have with lands into trust is that once you do that, it's really hard to have real full access of that land. There are limits on what you can do with it. I'm not an expert on that, Helen, but I'm happy to work with the tribes and also the ANCs in such a way to make sure that whatever we do is beneficial to the people that have the land. The thing that we've got to be focused on is that the health of Alaska depends on the health of rural Alaska. And my commitment to those that live in rural Alaska is I'm going to do everything to create jobs and purpose for you there, and also address the other needs that we have, because, again, it's a direct relationship. Health of Alaska depends on the health of rural Alaska.
This is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is U.S. Senate candidate Libertarian Joe Miller. You can join the conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The idea of the state and tribes co-managing land, are you talking about equal footing, or what would that look like?
Co-management, especially in native areas, the 44 million acres that we're talking about, and this is something that I think all Alaskans can get behind. And the 44 million acres of native-owned land, I believe that the tribes should have the ability to manage in a way that they see fit. Their land, why not? I mean, I have yet to run into, even the sportsmen's groups, I have yet to run into somebody that's opposed to that concept. And the beauty of it is, once that relationship, because the state has lots of resources. The state has a lot of science behind management. They know it a lot better than the federal government does, but in combination with the tribes, things can be managed for game maximization in a way that fits with the objective of the tribes and their people for subsistence uses, and then that can be extended into federal land. I believe that is the way forward. It gets rid of this intractable issue, the conflict that we've had over the years on the subsistence versus the sport or the urban uses, and it makes sense. I have, like I said, most people that hear that, they think, well, yeah, that's right, Joe. Why aren't we doing that?
Tribes are entering this idea of increasing the recognition of tribal sovereignty. Tribes are entering into agreements with the state to take on criminal cases in tribal courts. You're an attorney. You were a magistrate is this the right direction for the state and for tribes?
I started the first rural therapeutic drug court, maybe even the first therapeutic drug court period in the state, back when I was the magistrate in Tok. I worked with the native tribes in the process of doing that. Tanacross, Tetland, Northway. We also had in our district Eagle Village, went out to Mentasta Lake. Worked closely because we tried to come up with alternative means of addressing recidivism. It was a huge issue. A lot of folk that would come before me had been there many, many times before, and it seemed like the old system wasn't working. And so we came up through a cooperative approach with a therapeutic course of action, which actually created a much, much reduced rate of recidivism. I do believe that the only way that you can address the criminal justice issues, particularly in rural Alaska, is through, at the very minimum, a cooperative approach where the villages understand their issues and they understand what's necessary in order to bring these intractable problems under control. If a group, and this is the whole concept of federal libertarianism, if you want to create local control and local rule, you should be permitted to do that. And I think the state ought to cooperate with those efforts. And it's something that I support because I think, again, when you have government closest to home, it's most accountable and it most properly addresses the issues that your communities face. Law enforcement issues, intractable problem again, something else that needs to be addressed. The VPSO system, not working very well. Didn't work during the time I was out in Tok. And it's something that is also going to need to be addressed. And we have some ideas, some concepts to address that as well.
So the idea of tribes taking on more criminal jurisdiction in a lot of communities, in reservation communities, there's been what's known as Public Law 280, that the states maintained criminal jurisdiction. Some of that's changing in some areas, excuse me, some reservations. But what are your thoughts about that, about the tribes taking on criminal cases in their communities?
Well, obviously, it's going to require some legal changes for that to happen. And in order to do it, you need to make sure that you have effective systems in place where the Constitution is protected. I mean, that's really the baseline. I don't think you're going to face much in the way of opposition from anybody on this as long as the constitutional parameters are followed. You've got to make sure you got due process. You've got to make sure that you don't have any type of influences that could create a lack of justice in a case. And as long as you've got those things in place, I think that most people would embrace the concept of more local control that addresses their issues more directly. I mean, the people that are most affected adversely by crimes, the victims are in those villages, are the ones that are probably going to be the most able to address it. As long as, again, you've got a proper system in place that protects the baseline constitutional rights that we all have, and due process, of course, being foremost amongst those.
All right, let's go back to the phones. JD is in Esther. Hi, JD.
Hello, Lori. This is J.D. Reagan. I'm a member of Labor's Union Local 942 in Fairbanks, Alaska. And Joe, I have two questions for you that are really important to my union, so I'd appreciate a straightforward yes or no answer. The first is, do you support Davis-Bacon? And the second is, do you support raising the minimum wage?
Well, and I apologize, JD, those are not simple yes-no answers. I believe that the state has the right to establish what wage it sees fit. I think the federal minimum wage is something that, again, is not designed or not intended constitutionally. State has the right to do it if it desires. In fact, our state has. It goes outside of the federal minimum wage. With respect to Davis-Bacon, I believe that we should contract in the state and then at the federal level so that everybody gets the best deal possible. If, in fact, Davis-Bacon is something that requires or is moves us in that direction, perhaps so. But I do believe that one of the things that has to be addressed is the extreme federal deficit that we're under. We're at $20 trillion right now. $13 trillion of that debt accumulated under the time that Lisa Murkowski has been in the Senate. We know that the federal money to the state is shrinking. And in fact, contracts to Fairbanks have gone down, federal contracts. We, of course, got the F-35s that are coming, thanks to Representative Don Young. But the fact of the matter remains that we have a shrinking federal purse. And so this idea that we continue to spend money at the greatest rate we possibly can, I think the only way that we're going to be able to create higher wages in the long term in the state of Alaska is through extracting wealth from the ground. And you look at the resource extraction that occurs throughout the state and the wages that are set. Davis-Bacon doesn't set the wages up on the North Slope. Davis-Bacon doesn't set the wages at Fort Knox Gold Mine, or Pogo Gold Mine. Those are created by the need for good labor, good wages paid, and as a consequence of that, we have good jobs in Alaska. And again, these are resource-based jobs. The federal money to the state is shrinking. We need to approach those things that can actually create more jobs for our kids and grandkids, and that's my commitment to you, J.D., is I'm going to do everything I can to create those good jobs so that good women, men and women in the state have the opportunity to provide for their families and not continue to face this shrinking environment of recession. Again, third quarter of recession. It's going to take bold new leadership in the state, transformational leadership, to put us on a road to wealth instead of the dead-end road that the 36-year Murkowski dynasty has led us down.
Joe, there was a recent effort to repeal Davis-Bacon in the Congress. Would you support that effort to repeal Davis-Bacon?
I'd have to read the bill, J.D. I've not read it, so I can't answer you directly, and I'm not going to make a comment on it until I've read it.
So you do not support Davis-Bacon, yes or no? Can you give me a yes or no answer?
I said I'd have to read the bill. I'd have to read the bill before I told you whether or not I support or oppose it. I'm not going to go out there and just make a broad comment on something I haven't read.
What about in general? Do you support Davis-Bacon, yes or no? You're evading the question.
Well, when you say Davis-Bacon, are you tell me you're talking about for federal projects paying a certain wage? Is that what your perspective is?
Yes.
I think the federal government ought to get the best deal it can get when it does its projects, but I think a fair wage ought to be paid.
Can I get a yes or no answer out of you? Do you support Davis-Bacon?
My perspective on Davis-Bacon is if it's a fair wage, it should be supported. If it's not a fair wage, it should not.
All right. Thanks, J.D., for the call. Let's go back to the phones. We have a lot of people who have other questions. Donna is in Tok. Hi, Donna.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. Hello? Did you have a question?
Hi, Donna. How are you doing?
Yes. I live in Tok, and I have a dry cabin here. And I know he was a former magistrate here in Tok who's familiar. Now, I don't have a septic or a well, and usually I can go get community water, but everybody put their hoses away for the year, and you know, because it's freezing here now. But guess what? There's no place to get water, and I don't have water. So what's in the works maybe for, with the shrinking federal budget? I mean, the waiting list for a septic or a well is about 3 years long. But as a disabled veteran, Alaska Native female, I feel like, shucks, why, I shouldn't be living in such third world conditions. And we're talking Tok. That, Chevron put away their water, Northern Energy put away their water. There is no place to get water. So help me, Joe. Where do I get it? There's a creek about 15 miles away.
Well, I spent several years in Tok. We actually did our own well there. We had it drilled. We built our own septic system. It was a crib system. Most of the people in Tok use crib systems. It was an interesting environment. We used an outhouse, Donna, for 6 months, my wife and I did, while we're in Tok. So we understand what it's like not to have sewage facilities. We know what it's like not to have running water in our home because we actually lived that way for a number of months. There are a lot of people in Tok that it's a hard environment. In fact, I saw you guys were at 24 below zero the other day.
Yes.
We actually, when I was in Tok, we had 70 below zero for several days in a row. I remember bumping into my mirror on my Suburban and it shattered the plastic housing on the back of it. It was so cold. I spent the night in St. Michael's about a week ago. And Stebbins, which is right adjoining, we were in Stebbins as well. Stebbins does not have running water either. And the thing that's interesting about many of these outlying bush areas is that their conditions that they have today are about the same that they were 36 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that's inexcusable. I believe that we should have the facilities that a modern world, that most people in a modern world have. And we need to do everything that we can to help facilitate that. I mean, where people, you're a disabled veteran. I appreciate your service. And I think that...
Thank you.
I think that, one of the things that we need to have a commitment to is making sure that we don't break trust with our veterans, especially those that have the commitment of the federal government to continue to provide medical care. I think where we can, we as a people should do those things that we need to do to provide for ourselves. That's a primary. But where we need infrastructure, and this is something that the state of Alaska has been so shortchanged on, we've got a federal government that owns many more acres than what the state government owns, many more acres than what natives own, and they've kept us from the development of those resources. If we had full access to our resource base, as was anticipated in statehood, the value that we could get from those would provide more than enough funding to provide additional resources and infrastructure to our bush areas to provide for their needs, such as running water, septic, et cetera. I think that there is an obligation of the federal government to our state in the fact that they have trapped up those resources. And until they release them, there's an obligation. Now, my main political approach to the federal government in Washington, D.C., is to pry open that resource base so that we can create wealth. We have more than enough resource base to create wealth in this state, I think, even similar to what we see in some of the Arab countries. I mean, you look at, you know, for example, the United Arab Emirates, you look at, Bahrain and some of these other places that have incredible resources, smaller population like Alaska, and those people live like kings. And why is that? They've got unrestricted use of the resource base, and it's used effectively for the people. This concept of poverty that we have in Alaska and this idea that we're trapped in this dead-end road is something we've got to break free of and recognize that there is opportunity to go a different direction. If we continue to say that the only way out is federal funding, we have the past as a directive for the future, and that is it's a dead-end road. The money is shrinking. Stebbins still has no running water. There are many other places throughout Alaska that have no running water, and it's worse or the same, at least today, as it was, you know, three decades ago. So the current approach isn't working. I think we have to create wealth through the ground, and with the wealth through the ground, there is no reason why we can't create the infrastructure we need so that people can live in first world, not third rural conditions.
Thank you, Donna, for the call. Let's stay on that track. This has been a big theme during this hour about opening up resource development in Alaska. You just referenced the Arab nations, where I've heard it characterized that they essentially can stick a straw in the sand and oil comes out. So their development costs are much, much lower than what we have in Alaska. Kalis just says, this company says they've found a massive oil deposit. But until prices, something happens with the prices, it doesn't seem as if we're going to have a big run on companies wanting to develop what is here. How would you work to make those things happen if there is all the resources that we need in the ground? How can that be put forward? A while ago, we were talking about subsidies. Is that what it's going to take? Should the state have to subsidize this to get these things out of the ground? What's the right mix there?
Yeah, no, I disagree that subsidies are necessary. And in fact, I disagree that there are substantial costs involved when you talk about a Trans-Alaskan pipeline that's already in place and fairly co-located with many of the resources that we're banned from getting. MPRA and we're both are co-located close enough to the TAPS pipeline that the infrastructure costs are not all that substantial. It is a matter of governmental prohibition, the federal government saying no. MPRA half off limits now.
So you think if the MPRA was open that ConocoPhillips, BP, that companies would be there?
I believe that the independents also need to have a seat at the table. This concept that we're dependent on the three big producers, I just think it's wrongheaded. I mean, you look at what's happened in the lower 48 with independent action before prices started to drop. We have the capacity. Of course, our production of oil cost here are less than what we saw in the Dakotas with the fracturing that was going on. If, again, we address those opportunities that we have that are co-located with the Trans-Alaskan pipeline, I can tell you that if tomorrow Obama had a vision and decided that he needed to open ANWR and MPRA, first of all, I think the Senate would go along with him. But I can tell you it would be an economic boon like none other in this state, and it would create wealth, immediate wealth. And the amount of money and investment that would pour in this state would make all of us, all of our economic positions in the state, much better than they are today. And the problem is, you know, it's a twofold issue. We've got not just the shrinking federal pot, so we don't have that to depend on. We've got a state government that's upside down. Let me add the third tier to it. The PFD's half gone this year. You can pretty much count on losing the next half probably next year unless we take a different approach. We are in a position in the state that is clearly an economic dead-end road. And everybody that's out there that thinks that the federal government, at least as far as the easy money goes, is the answer, it's just going to bring us more poverty. It's like I was on a radio interview the other day in Sandpoint, and the interviewer asked me, and really great interview, by the way, what are we going to do in a post-oil Alaska? And I said, this is waving the white flag of surrender. It's essentially putting us all in a track toward poverty in the state. We're going to lose people. We're going to have no jobs. Our kids are going to continue to go outside, and people are going to lack purpose in the bush. We have opportunities at our fingertips if we apply real political pressure and leverage in that direction. And there are many others in the Congress, like us. I mean, we have a lot of Western states that have a desire to have control over the resources. There's something called the equal footing doctrine, which is states that enter the Union were supposed to be on equal footing with the original states. And yet we've been kept in this position of serfdom, almost colonization, where we got our hand out for this ever-diminishing share that's led us down this road of poverty, yet under our feet sits the most extraordinary wealth that one could ever imagine. And it's not just oil. It's not just hydrocarbons. I mean, I believe in a diversified economy. And, you know, the strong fisheries, I mean, obviously we've got to protect against predatory fishing. We've got a timber industry that Bill Clinton killed back in the 90s, which we could, again, revive and create hundreds of millions of dollars of economic activity. We have rare earth minerals unlike any other, and yet we're going to China now for all this stuff, and yet we have under our feet the ability to create wealth, and it's something that we shouldn't be naysayers about. It's not something that we say, hey, we need subsidies for. We do need infrastructure. We need roads. That's clear, to gain access to some of the resources, but some are right there where with low cost we can provide the oil to fill back up the pipeline. It's sitting at one-third right now, and I'm convinced with the correct political leverage we can do that.
All right, we're going to take another short break, and when we come back, our conversation with U.S. Senate candidate Libertarian Joe Miller will continue as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
We're back, and we're going to go back to the phones now. Jim is in Anchorage. Hi, Jim.
Yes, if you're a good talker and able to get elected to office, doesn't matter which office, people start fawning over you and chasing after you for favors and making deals. So at the end of the day, you know, we the people end up being the enemy. And so how do you prevent that from happening when you get elected office and not developing a dynasty?
Absolutely fantastic question, Jim, and that is a problem that we're faced with in Congress day in, day out. People that seem to be well-intentioned get elected, and then they end up stabbing the people in the back. It happens 9 out of 10 times, maybe even more than that. I think the key, Jim, is to make sure that you're surrounded by the right people. One of the beauties of the 2010 election, I see that we learned a lot from that race, and it was very educational as to how things work and how the leadership – the corrupt political leadership of both parties are after one thing, and that's scratching the back of those that them matter, and it's not the people. We've got to make sure that we have people surrounding us, and the people that have come behind this campaign, that have stuck with it for the last 6 years, are people that are we the people type people. They are average, everyday folk. None of them wealthy. They're all people that have to make a scratch, you know, from the ground or work hard to make sure that they can earn money for their families. Jim, they're like you and I. I mean, we've got budgets that we got to meet. You know, we have kids we've got to feed. We have people that are in the mix. When you surround yourself with good people that have the commitment and the objective that is aligned with the platform of the campaign, and that is making sure that the people's interests are satisfied rather than the special interests. That's by far one of the best ways to maintain and ensure that you're doing that for the people. The other thing I might add is if you've met Kathleen, she's an extraordinary woman. That she is she would never allow me to go that direction. You know, she's a first generation American, by the way. Her mom is from mom and dad both from foreign countries. Mom's from Austria, dad's from England, and she's just an average everyday person that really cares about people. And I can tell you, she'll keep my feet to the fire. I can assure you that.
So you would be in favor of term limits?
I think term limits are a great idea. I don't think we should unilaterally disarm. I think that's a mistake. But I do think that one of the problems we have is perpetuation of power. And people people get leveraged in all sorts of ways. You know, you see political figures go up and do something completely different as what they've said on the campaign trail, and you think, what in the world just happened? And I think we've seen a touch of that in the presidential race, where there's attempts to use information to leverage people in certain directions. I think, you know, and one of the things, you know, I'm a Christian. I really believe that I'm accountable to more than just myself. And from my perspective, that is another limiting factor. And I'm not saying that there should be any type of religious test. Don't get me wrong. But I'm just expressing to you what internal motivation I've got. And it's to do the right thing. It truly is. It's not that I've always made the right decisions, but my commitment to the Alaskan people is that I am going to do everything I can to do the right thing. And I recognize that I'm accountable to more than just myself.
I want to plow through a couple more questions in our final few minutes here. We have a email question. Karen in Fairbanks says, with Mr. Miller running as a libertarian, a party that largely wants the government to stay out of people's lives, how does that jive with your stance on women's reproductive rights?
Well, I think there's a constitutional right to life. Unequivocal on that. I think the 15th Amendment provides for that. I think that if we're going to say that government doesn't protect life, then what other liberties are up for grabs? And I would suggest to you, I'd posit that all liberties are up for grabs. And I think, you know, a nation that defends the most defenseless is one that we should all support and get behind. So I'm unequivocal on that. I know there's some disagreement out there. But my perspective is flat out. I'm a pro-life guy.
All right. Let's go back to the phones quickly. Chase is in Fairbanks. Hi, Chase. Can you give us a question quickly?
Yes, Jill. Recently, there's been, we're talking about the effects of anthropogenic climate change on local Alaskans. And recently, we've noticed an uptick in oyster larvae deaths associated with ocean acidification in Southeast Alaska. This is impacting growers, shellfish growers, and an industry that provides to the economy of Alaska. What would you do if elected to help these guys, these shellfish growers in Southeast, if they could no longer grow shellfish larvae?
Yeah, I mean, fisheries is a perfect example of where there ought to be federal involvement, because it doesn't just impact one state, it impacts other states, other nations. And so there has to be a cooperative approach taken to protect the industry. And where there is something that is adversely impacting producers, there has to be a federal answer to it. I mean, that's the reality. I'm for a limited federal government, but there are some areas of action, particularly when we're talking about the valuable industry that sustains a large part of the Alaskan economy, that have to be addressed at the federal level.
All right. Thanks for that question, Chase. My last question would be, Congress is deeply divided, has been, and the presidential race has certainly deepened those divisions within parties. Are you concerned about this in a general sense, and what it may mean for congressional leaders being able to come together and get work done after November 8th?
Well, you know, I've been pretty clear on this, and some of your listeners may disagree. I think that a Hillary Clinton president would be devastating to Alaska. It would shut down development. Again, it would keep us on this dead-end road to poverty. I believe that a Trump, despite the issues that Trump has, I think that a Trump presidency would actually advance the interest of Alaska. And I believe that as a libertarian, and this is kind of the card that I bring to the table, one, where Trump does stuff he shouldn't be doing, I can do what I can to hold him accountable. The beauty of potentially being that tie-breaking vote in the Senate is it allows me a degree of leverage also on the leadership of the Senate. So I think sitting outside of both parties, caucusing with, you know, and again, making sure that we have the majority leader that we want, caucusing with the correct party gives us the opportunity to create real benefit and objective to the state of Alaska.
All right. Thank you so much, U.S. Senate Libertarian candidate Joe Miller. Next week, we will have incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. It's no secret that salmon is important to Alaskans. It brings us together across communities, cultures, and economies. Discover what you can do to ensure healthy runs of salmon for generations to come by visiting salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
There are changes to the way you can share your thoughts or concerns with the University of Alaska Board of Regents. You can phone from anywhere in Alaska and provide your testimony to the Regents on Monday, October 31st from 4 to 6 p.m. or attend an informal evening gathering in Fairbanks on Thursday, November 10th from 5:30 to 7. You can also write to the Regents at alaska.edu/bor/public-testimony. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.